Welcome to Art Moves.
I have a story that happened to me a while back. I was going to a museum conference in Baltimore, the American Alliance of Museum. And I showed up at the train station in Baltimore, and I got in a cab with this African-American woman around 40-ish. And I told her that I'm going to the Marriott. And halfway through the trip, she started to tell me that she came out of an abusive relationship. She had four kids, and she's writing a book that she was publishing. And I was thinking about the story, and a story came to mind about an old Sanskrit tale about a woman who saved the Pasha, I think it was, from drowning. And he offered to give her anything, gems, jewels, whatever. And she said, just give me one grain of rice and then double it every day for 30 days. And he was surprised because he figured, what the hell, one grain of rice, how much could that be? Now, the backstory of this is that the population was starving and there was a huge storehouse of rice. But if mathematically, if you look at it, what happens is that she ended up at the end of 30 days emptying all the storehouses of rice. Part of it came to the people and part of it gave back to the, of course, the royal family so they could eat too, of course. And I was telling her this story, and I was saying the reason I was telling this story is that if you think several generations forward, like three or four or five, her bravery, her courage of ability to stop this legacy of abuse means that she's now impacting positively 200-300 people. Right now, both of us have moved, we're in tears, and she lets me off at the Hilton. The problem is I'm staying at the Marriott.
This is Art Moves, curated conversations on art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking to people in the creative arts, from visual and performing artists, musicians, writers, dancers, museum directors, curators, critics, gallerists, and everyone else.
So this is Art Moves. I'm Eli Kislansky, and I have my co-host.
I'm Tony William. And Eli, that was such a great story for what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about how art can heal, art can inform, and art can transform. And we're going to be doing that with Ceci Davidson. Now, to our listeners, I wanted to share a little bit about Ceci. She's a prolific and visionary, unique artist. In the last decade, she has written and produced more than 200 short plays to nourish the mind and soul. Ceci's plays are wildly imaginative, funny, disturbing, and touching. These plays have inspired an ongoing dialogue with the Harlem residents about personal, political, and spiritual issues affecting individual lives and the collective community at large. So we are so very happy to have you here with us, Ceci. This is something that I've wanted to do for some time because, to me, this is how art moves in a really authentic and transformative way.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Tony and Eli. Good to be here. I'd like to give you some background to the excerpts of a play called Baby Doll that you are going to hear. So the character is Clara, a woman. The setting is present-day New York City, Clara and Antoine's apartment. There's a bed and a night table. Clara is lying down in bed with her legs spread open. She wears intimate apparel underneath a robe. She waits for her husband to arrive. And now you'll hear her husband, Antoine.
Stop begging. I'm training you to become a lady. Ladies don't beg. All right, baby doll? Or you can use the loafers. Yeah, that was real nice, baby doll. You were respectful. You didn't cry. Kiss, kiss. Now lie across the bed and get ready for me. I'm going to have my smoke outside. Then I'll be back to finish my business.
I'm a good girl. I'm his baby doll. Antoine would never stray from me. Daddy goes to work, and then he comes home to me. He gets what he wants the way he wants it. You don't get it. Men say they want a beautiful, intelligent, and ambitious woman. A match. All a man really wants is a baby doll. An imaginary virgin.
And on the day Clara decides to leave Antoine.
I'm a good girl. I'm his baby doll. Antoine would never stray from me. Daddy goes to work, and then he comes home to me. He gets what he wants the way he wants it. You don't get it. Men say they want a beautiful, intelligent, and ambitious woman. A match. All a man really wants is his baby doll. An imaginary virgin.
And on the day Clara decides to leave Antoine.
1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000, 5-1000. Get up, sister. This is the day the Lord has made. This is the day the Lord has made. 3 minutes to walk downstairs, 10 minutes to go to the subway, 3 hours downtown and back. Good, good. No, maybe he'll go to a neighborhood store. No subway. 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Then maybe this isn't the day.
Thank you.
Okay. And for our listeners, Ceci has written a play that deals in the area of domestic violence. So what inspired you to write this play, Baby Doll?
It's actually difficult for me to answer that question, what inspired me, because with my process, I don't go out searching. I allow myself to experience the emotions, I pay attention to what I observe, and I allow the plays to evolve organically out of whatever triggers happen. So I would say that it's easier for me to respond to how did Baby Doll evolve as I evolved in my understanding of domestic violence. And that is when I understood over time that women stay and leave in these abusive relationships for the same reasons, love and fear. For example, they stay in a relationship because they fear how they will survive if they leave. They leave a relationship because they fear for their lives. They stay in a relationship because they believe the man needs love, that they are the person to give them that love, and they leave a relationship for love because they decide they love themselves more.
So in these instances, are you actually writing about trauma?
Yes, I am writing about trauma. I wouldn't say that I sit down and say, oh, I'm going to write a play about trauma. I write about characters and what they experience. And it may be trauma, it may be love, it may be a variety of dimensions of emotions and experiences.
These issues are so raw and intimate. Talk to us about how you engaged community in actually participating in this work.
So this particular story has evolved over time. When I first presented this play as a stage reading, after the play, I felt the audience wanting some sharing or some relief. And so when I produced it again, I constructed more pieces to the experience. So we had the play, then we had post-show conversation as a group, and then with the 26th Precinct in Harlem, and then we broke into small groups with a leader I placed. For example, some of the small groups had a social worker as part of the experience to make sure that everyone's voice was heard and honored. So with this level of very intimate community engagement, I was very pleased to see that people felt safe to share.
Antoine talks about almost like a way that he's being benevolent about using loafers. So he's not going to use boots with nails or something in it. And in his world, he's doing a good thing for her. But I think what's interesting about that to me is that almost this sort of like genteel approach to it in his mind is almost hides the real dark side of what's really happening to a certain extent.
Well, I don't believe that Antoine feels this is dark. I think he feels this is loving. And this is the world that was created in their intimate relationship. And there are some lines in the play where Clara talks about she's worried about Antoine and the love that he needs because as a child he was beat by his mother. So I think it's part of it is, you know, how the cycle of abuse continues. And if this is the world that you're accustomed to, it may not look like abuse or feel like abuse. It's your world, and this is what you know.
Is it also something that Clara's accustomed to, too, or is it just on that side of Anton who's the abuser?
It's hard to say. This is her world now, which she has accepted.
So it's not always the case.
Yes.
You know what? I would venture to say it seems as though it must be a language that was spoken to her. Otherwise, why would one tolerate it? Meaning, how do you go from...
Familiarity.
Yeah. Meaning, how would you go from a loving home and family and understanding how the language of love is and then get yourself into an abusive situation? As I'm talking about it, I'm starting to almost answer my own question. But it would seem as though 9 times out of 10, this is what people have grown accustomed to or what she might have seen when she grew up as well.
Again, I'm not an expert on domestic violence, but I've experienced many and observed many different ways that this plays out and is not always a very simple dot-to-dot straight line of how this occurs. Women who you would believe, how could they accept this with the kind of family they come from?
Right.
Are victims. That's why it's often so surprising when we think about the statistics of domestic violence. 1 out of 4 women have been assaulted, which is a low estimate. That's just reported. And there's also different levels of abuse. We have hard statistics on homicide, domestic violence that results in homicide. But there are also other kinds of assault that occurs that don't get reported. I mean, how many women are going to call the police department or request an order of protection because every day their husband body shames them?
You would call that domestic violence?
I would say
psychological violence. Right?
I would say that any time
no one would do that.
But any time an environment is created where the woman feels unsafe, unloved, uncared for, not respected, insecure on a consistent day. But this is different from you burn the dinner. This is every day feeling insecure, disrespected, not cared for, not loved. That creates a world that you are insecure.
Question around safe spaces when you had these breakouts after the play. How were you able to ensure that? Because when people talk about situations in their home lives, especially when it comes to African Americans, we're basically taught to keep your home life to yourself. How were you able to bring out a population that was willing to share some of these struggles? Because there's stigmas attached. There may be some embarrassment.
Is there cultural also?
And many cultures have that same kind of keep it to yourself.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
No demographics, right?
I think the intimacy that I attempted to create between the artists and the audience allowed that. So this is absolutely not the kind of play that could be presented on Broadway with us, you know, 600,
not My Fair Lady for sure.
1,000 people in the audience.
No songs.
This was meant to be and designed to be an intimate experience and exchange between the artists and the audience so that the audience was not just observer but was allowed to experience the words in a real way. And breaking into small groups with a group leader helped to keep some semblance of control because there were both victims and perpetrators in the audience.
You're saying that during the play that you actually do like sort of a breakdown session at the end or something?
Is yes, absolutely.
Oh, very interesting, right.
So that was done with the whole
audience.
It,
in a way.
Yes,
that's
it was done with
right,
the domestic violence unit
right.
from the police department, and it was done with small group leaders.
Wow, so it's not just an art form, it's also
right.
a form of social justice, too, right?
Yeah, and were they trained? Yeah. Who were the group leaders? What their backgrounds look like?
So, for example, one group leader was a social worker. Mm-hmm. Another group leader was a victim of domestic violence who had overcome her circumstances, including homelessness, leaving her former husband, and then remarrying and being
happy. She was a group leader, right?
She was a group leader.
What an inspiration she must have been.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I tried to be very careful so everyone could feel good from the experience, even though the content was very deep and dark and heavy.
You're the one who selects and vets the people, I assume, right?
Yes,
that's
I do.
Interesting, right? No, I just had a question. I was curious about what the genesis of the character...
Clara.
What was this sort of inspirational spark that says, oh, I should do a play about Clara and then Antoine? Like, what was it? Was it like a formulation of, like, people you met and ran into, life experiences? How did this sort of come together? Sort of like, who was the muse for this, if you will?
I can't really say that there was any one muse. What I can safely say is that this play probably evolved from all of my years of experience working as a therapist and observing people who suffer. Is this a copy of a story that someone revealed to me? No, I don't write in that way. But the torment that Clara felt, I have felt through actual people in my life encounters.
So it's almost like ambient radiation in some ways, where it sort of drifts in from a number of different sources.
Yes, exactly.
Formulate,
different streams of information
yeah.
and different right. streams of experiences.
Yeah, amazing. But I was going to say the other thing, too, is that it's interesting because it's more than just entertainment. It's really like...
Yes.
Well, I was wondering...
Making a difference to society to a large extent. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's taking something that is intense and raw and making it into some kind of entertainment.
Yes.
There's a genius there. Talk to us about how... Really, that's a
well,
genius
it is,
to be
yeah.
able to write something and I'm experiencing it and she's killing me softly, and I'm still sitting there watching it, I think that's really, really unique.
It's like a carrier wave.
Right. right?
That sends
well,
a signal that information.
I love those
it.
Tech examples.
Yeah.
That's really...
right, right. I have a little book I flipped through.
Right, right. We come from who we are.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you do that? Because I want to talk about your book, Articulation. You
yes.
have one where there's a bunny that... their text messages, Veronica Bunny it's called,
yes.
and it's about gender fluidity. Then you have another something you've written called Dream Mother. I really related to that one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he had another one where you were dealing with the African-American woman who was sexually traumatized in Italy, you know.
Actually, it was in Brooklyn.
Oh, it was Brooklyn, but they were speaking Italian.
Well, because she was an Italian scholar.
Oh, it was in Brooklyn, so, okay.
It was in Brooklyn. She
yes.
was an Italian
mm-hmm.
scholar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that time, she was... Should I spoil it? Should I spoil
no,
it?
No,
no,
tell me. No, yeah, no, absolutely spoil it.
So she had impeccable Italian. She
I
was an Italian scholar.
That,
and she had gone to study with study partners, and she was trying to leave a particular area of Brooklyn at a particular time, and she was assaulted.
I grew up in Brooklyn. I was born there. There's a particular part. No, I'm asking because it makes a big difference.
Well,
it's like
I think
Bay Ridge or something, or
yeah, I think you know they're different.
Oh, it's not the script.
You know, there are
like
many parts of Brooklyn where this could have happened.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Back in that time, she's
a
recalling
community.
A memory
yeah.
mm-hmm. that she can't erase.
Right, so it's irrelevant where.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. I think. What is so compelling about this story is that when she came home to Harlem on the train, she was bleeding, and no one asked her if she was okay.
Right. In Dream Mother, this youngster has a mother who is a drug addict.
Yes.
And you know what it made me think? Because I've seen situations like this on the subway train where
sure.
you see a mother that is has such contempt for their children. And I wonder, what is my role as a bystander? You know, there are times when I see some young mother just cussing at a little 2.5-year-old, and I just feel like I want to intervene.
I often ask how you're doing.
Oh, you do ask
Oh, yeah,
question?
You bet.
How do you, what do? You say,
how are you doing? How's your day going?
Ah.
You say that to the
really?
Mother?
I said it to a bunch of people. The guys
yes.
lying on the street.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, there's a very interesting yes. research experiment, right? And
yes.
this was a seminary.
Mm.
So yes. these people are studying to be priests, right? I forgot which book it's in. And they did this research experiment where they had a guy lie on the middle of the sidewalk. And they did two groups of people. And one, they said they had to get to a class by a certain time. It was amazing how many of them stepped over this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, to hear a lecture about the Good Samaritan. It's like, you know, hello.
But I think that we're moving into a society where bystanders are being activated. At least that's what I'm hearing and seeing.
I think it's weird.
That we don't, you know, the next time I see a moment like that, I'm going to have to think, or something's going to have to come over me in terms of what is it that I want to say to intervene.
How many times do you see a guy in the street, like an old guy in the street, slumped over? Guy could be having a heart attack. Or, you know.
Yeah, well, typically, I might. It depends on a whole lot of things there,
no,
me
of
being
course.
A female.
You have to change it. Yeah,
but again, you know, you're using your art as a way of informing, educating, and healing. And so, in all three of these short plays that you did, what is your objective? I hope I didn't just spoil it by saying that, but what is your objective? What is your goal when you are writing? What is it that you're conveying?
So or what the outcomes what mm-hmm. the outcomes are.
Like so I have a goal with my process. I mm-hmm. let the play write itself. I have a wild mind. That's my process, which means I just let the words come out, and intellectually I try not to get in the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's highly intuitive and motive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what is my goal as a writer? I would say I'm trying to celebrate humanity, our shared humanity. I'm trying to get at the core of emotions that make us connected as people. And I want my work to be culturally responsive so that it stimulates intelligent conversation, reflection, and change.
Because you're talking about specific outcomes. Like,
well, I think that I
heard it. Measurable outcomes.
No, I heard it. You know, because I think I understand. She wants her work to be meaningful and to create inner change. That people will
yes.
be activated. After
right.
seeing something, if I am in a similar situation, there is some chord, some word, some energy that makes me say, you know what? Damn it, it's time for me to change the situation.
Yes.
Now, talk to us about your background. Because you didn't go to a school to learn to play right, right?
No, I didn't.
Hey, play right, right? Play right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No,
truth comes
I didn't.
Out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I came from a very different route. So I have a PhD from the Graduate School and University Center of Center University of New York in speech, language, hearing sciences. So the bulk of my adult career has been as a speech-language pathologist, providing therapy for children and working with children and families. So in that experience, I realized when I did start to be a playwright, which was in 2009, I realized that for my whole adult career, I've been listening to people.
I was saying to myself,
to
what a good listener you are.
And helping right? people I'm communicate with each other. And so my strength was, I learned as a writer, was in dialogue. Listening, creating authentic dialogue that revealed who characters were. So kind of a different route. And then I did.
But that's art to me. You know, we can all take art form and make it something. It's an expression. You're
yes.
expressing.
There's also an epiphany embedded mm-hmm. in that, right? So mm-hmm. the question is then for you, okay. It's one of those questions. So the epiphany is that, you know, for some people, it's like spot welding. You know, for example, like Stieglitz, who never thought he'd be a photographer, you know, and until it was his 16th birthday and somebody handed him a camera.
Right.
Same thing happened with Gary, but I won't go into that story now. But was it something like that, or was it sort of like drifting, like you were a canoe down the river, and then things sort of showed up, and then it just led you to this, you know, way to go or something?
I guess it was a little different kind of experience. It just, I had a feeling that something needed to change my life.
Ha.
And mm-hmm. I just had a feeling. I didn't know why. I didn't know how. And to make a long story short, I'll just tell you, I ended up in a convent in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
And the writing came through meditation and reflection.
In the convent.
at the convent.
I could have sensed that about you.
In French or English? In French or English?
Well, there was
no, you know, but I could
there
sense
was one
that.
Nun there who spoke English. Everyone else spoke French. And so when I arrived, she said, "We only have one record," because I took a vow of silence.
Wow.
And so she said, "We only have one requirement. This is going to be where you stay." And they gave me an apartment in the basement of the convent. She said, "The one requirement is that you have meals with us." And that was it.
You know, this does not surprise me
at all. Come on, she's hanging
out
in the cell. That's it. No breakfast. Then go back to the cell. What's going on?
No. See, he's not. I understand this.
You're so mean, Eli.
He doesn't get it. But he will in time. I wonder about that. You're talking about a very deeply spiritual journey.
No, I get this. But this one, though, the mechanics. Like,
there are no mechanics to a spiritual journey. See, that's it. Now we're there. There are no mechanics. It's about letting.
No. That part I totally get. Yeah. I totally get the serendipitous aspect to it. The sort of Zen being with it. And, you know, I do. I know I came from Brooklyn, but I still we do get it. But the other part of it is, in some ways, is almost like a more rudimentary level. Like, you know, what was your schedule? The reason why...
Why are you asking that? Well, here's why I ask.
While living in Crown Heights, there was a guy next door who was writing his autobiography. But for the last 30 years, he never left his room. So what the hell was he writing? I mean, he's like, today I was...
But if I had beautiful grounds, I would go outside.
What did you do? I was quiet. Can you imagine
quiet,
that?
I could hear, you know, do you ever feel, Eli,
what?
In Brooklyn, that there's just so much noise you can't hear yourself?
Oh, we were too busy.
We
were moving all the time. We had to move.
So in this environment of being silent and having silence around me, I could hear more. I could reflect more. So that's when I got in the habit of writing every day.
Can I just get one little thing, please, in here?
Because I'm listening to this approach. I'm getting it. Now there is the world, meaning the actual producing of this work. How do you make that part happen? Being so led by, it's clearly a spiritual pursuit.
And a very private one.
But what comes out of the meditation is the work that we see. So how do you get it produced? How do you get into the world on that level?
Okay, so what I've explained to you was the process. And when I wrote my first play and I tried to follow all the rules, this is what a play looks like. You submit, you do this. I tried to follow all the rules, and I did, because I wanted to know if I was capable of doing that. Then I broke all the rules for myself.
But you had to learn the rules first.
Absolutely.
And that's what made the work powerful.
I had to learn the rules first. This is what people say should be in a play.
Right.
And then after I got that, I said, okay, now I don't have to do it that way. And so with producing, I have opportunity to have some things produced, but I don't let that limit me and stop me. I believe very special, very important woman told me, which is that destiny has to catch up with me.
That's what you're saying. I love that.
And that's my mother. So I keep writing. I write every day. And I believe as people get to know me, like you're getting to know me, that as people get to know me and my work, that I'll have more opportunities.
And you shared something on our conversation. The fastest way to get someplace is slow.
Yes.
Comment on that, because I liked that.
So I heard André Desheel say that at a luncheon. He was a keynote speaker, and it just really resonated with me. The fastest way to get somewhere is slow. And I believe that. And I used to think my middle name was Wait, because it seemed like things took a long time to come into fruition. But I don't worry about that anymore. Can I let that stop me? I still write every day, and I believe the gifts will come. Meeting new people, people reading the work, my book. I believe this book is the first of many. I need someplace to put all the rest of the stories I have. So I believe it will come.
You also shared with me compassion fatigue.
Yes.
How does one get tired of being compassionate? And maybe that's not what it is when you speak of compassion fatigue.
So I know there, you know, I'm not a psychotherapist or psychiatrist, so I know there are all kind of technical ways that people talk about compassion fatigue, including compassion fatigue driving someone to be indifferent about others. So I can only comment on how I experience it, which is when you are sensitive to the suffering of others, it's exhausting. And so I have to remember, give myself breaks, rest.
Almost like a caregiver to a certain extent,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Just remember to take care of myself so that the work can come through.
Yeah, because I was wondering, how do you continue to do work like this, which is heavy, and still keep that positive outlook, you know, still keep that upbeat spirit, that sense of optimism, when we're dealing with issues that are heavy?
You have to find the joy, even in the suffering. And I'll give you an example. And this isn't from, you know, again, like all of my experience feed the writing. But this was an experience from my therapeutic world. I was in a meeting with a mother and a grandmother, and the grandmother was blind. And everyone had been complaining about her granddaughter. She does this, she can't do this, she's this. And I said, you know, your daughter, your granddaughter wrote a beautiful story and drew a beautiful picture. And the grandmother, blind, said, oh, I wish I could see that picture. I don't know how long I took at that meeting. And I think that perhaps some people there thought that this was irrelevant, but I painted that picture with my words to every detail possible. And the grandmother was full of tears of joy that someone would take the time to, one, talk about her granddaughter's ability and spirit and work in a positive way, show some great characteristics of her granddaughter, and help her to see in her mind what she couldn't physically see. So that was joyful.
Yes. I want to go back to where Eli was, and that's in the convent.
East Flappish.
No, not that far back. I'm tired of 1960 East Flappish.
We ain't trying to do that, Eli.
I got to say one thing.
For my own redemption, I got to say things. So we weren't just moving all the time, but I did have those moments personally because...
What moments are these that you're
just
speaking
like
of?
Meditative ones where you're sort of just sort of letting things in, being quiet and spiritual is when I drew as a kid, which I was extraordinarily good at. So that was the kind of things where, in some ways, you're sort of almost like being quiet at peace with the world and let it drift in, where you have also an element of control. So I think that was what it was for me.
But in
so we weren't just moving all the time.
No, absolutely.
Which we were, but most of the time.
When you speak of a convent, though, it speaks to spirituality and religion.
And also, why did she go?
Right. Yes. Right. That would be a really good question to ask.
Like, here I am
if
at a bar.
If you feel comfortable.
I know it sounds like really hokey, but, you know.
No, it doesn't.
Just to be doing something.
You know, I didn't know what I was supposed to do or where I was supposed to go, and I called this convent, and I just started talking.
You said, what the hell?
And the nun says, you know, wait a minute. You know, because she spoke French, and she got the one person who could speak English. And.
But why Montreal? I mean.
I could drive there.
And how long were you there?
At least a month, maybe 6 weeks.
Okay, so it was more like a retreat for you.
Well, she wasn't becoming a nun.
Right, yeah. Like, I wanted to make that really clear because I wasn't sure.
Oh, you mean like,
it sounded like when you went.
Yeah. No, I didn't even go to church.
Okay.
You know?
No, I totally
didn't even
get
go to church there. They had their spiritual work. I had my work.
So what are you working on now? What is it that we can look forward to seeing? Now, you did just publish a book,
yes.
Articulation.
So Articulation,
speak about that.
Published by Aqueduct Press. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is very exciting. This is the first time I've had a collection of my own work, just my own work in a book. So I'm very excited about that. And I'd like to continue having books published with my work. I have 5-6 in my mind already that I would love to find a nest for. I do work through the New York Public Library system, free plays for the community, and that's very important. And
are those the plays that we see in Articulation? Is that this sum total of your writing, but it says you've written 250 plays, so that's not 250 in there.
I stopped counting. Mm-hmm. You know, I write every day, and at the George Bruce Library, I present new work every mm-hmm. month. Mm-hmm. So I just, sometimes I can't keep up with myself. I just mm-hmm. focus on doing the work.
Absolutely.
So, and I'd love mm-hmm. to get produce more, because I like having books published with the plays, because it helps me feel some permanence of my gift to the world.
And how do
but
you
I'd like to yeah. see the productions as well?
And what are your networks? Because so often when people write, what I hear is, you know, I'm writing in solo. I don't have an opportunity to share my work or to partner or to hear what people think about what I am writing. How do you create that network of people that will listen to where it is you're going with your work? Or is that important to you?
You're talking about building an audience?
No, I'm talking about just when you're developing your work.
I see.
When you're developing, was it solo, or do you have a playwright network that you go to and you kind of share your ideas about what it is you're writing?
Like creative partners mm-hmm. or somebody mm-hmm. bounces stuff off of you?
Yeah, so as you're developing.
So I have a neighborhood girlfriend who is also a prolific writer, and she serves as my feedback partner and as my editor. So that's very helpful. And then having a live audience, when you have the responsibility of producing new work every month, like you keep it cracking. And, you know, so I just feel this is my work. I have to produce a play every month that's going to compel you.
Now, what I will say, because I'm getting the sign from our sound engineer, but I will say that this is the art that you do through writing your plays is clearly art that moves you.
Yes. So this is Eli Kaslansky and my host,
Tony Williams.
Art Moves is produced in partnership with Snaps Media and the Brooklyn Arts Council. Find some art that moves you and share it.